Happy New Year and welcome to the Violent Geek Podcast. I'm your host, Laurel Thompson, and today we're chatting with Jennifer Roy Francoli, a professional violinist, certified Alexander Technique instructor, and the creator of the Art of Freedom Method. Jennifer specializes in helping musicians of all kinds play with more ease and joy, less pain and performance anxiety, and less tension and stress. In our chat, we learn about Jennifer's path from concert violinist to her role as a coach, helping musicians feel and play better, and we explore how bringing more awareness to our lives can help us become better players, but also people in all the various roles that we play. As a teacher, Jennifer formerly taught the Alexander Technique at the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, and now teaches students at home in Cincinnati, Ohio, and around the world online. As a violinist, she has performed in concert halls around the world, including several performances at Carnegie Hall, and was able to study with some of the greatest violinists of all time, including Nathan Milstein, Joseph Gingold, Stanley Ritchie, and Shinichi Suzuki. Jennifer has just released a new book titled Make Great Music with Ease, The Secret to Smarter Practice, Confident Performance, and Living a Happier Life. And we welcome her to the Violin Geek Podcast to share how this work can help all of us listening. And before we dive in, I just want to mention that we are hearing a taste of Jennifer's music today. This episode's music selections are clips from her album Solo Con Spirito, Celebrating 50, and it features Bach's Partita No. 2, Jizé's Violin Sonata No. 3, Kreisler's Recitativo and Scherzo Caprice, and we'll be hearing bits and pieces of Enescu's Sarabande. I hope you enjoy my chat with Jennifer Roy Francoli. So just in reading your bio, I was seeing how it was sort of your exploration of spirituality and philosophy and different things like that that happened, I guess, was it your early 20s, maybe pretty early on, that then sort of changed your path away from what sounded like a very just sort of driven violin career. And I found that interesting that, you know, it kind of shifted you away from music. At the same time, now seeing your whole journey, it makes perfect sense. But I wonder at the time how that felt and what really caused you to have to kind of step back from music. Was it just it was becoming so sort of maybe competitive, and that didn't really connect with then this more spiritual side you were finding? Or how did that go for you? How did that feel?
Oh, wow. That's a great question and a big one. So it's actually interesting. You know, I'm 53 now, and looking back at that time, it feels like a lifetime ago. I'm totally the same person, but also a completely different person. So it's fun to look back and see the stages of my life. And in some ways, I've come full circle. And so just to try to answer your question, there's so much to it. But I was 19 and I was finishing up my bachelor's at Indiana University. And I was doing competitions. I typically would win the competitions. I had done a lot at that point, you know, performed internationally with orchestras and at Carnegie Hall a couple times by then. And yet I always felt like something was missing in my technique, and that I just couldn't do what I really wanted to do with my violin. And so there was this constant underlying frustration with my playing that nobody I knew was really able to help me with. And I had really excellent, top-notch teachers. I was very fortunate. And they didn't see anything wrong with my playing. So I was a bit on my own trying to figure out what was going on and not getting anywhere. And then I did an audition. It was the Julius Stahlberg International String Competition. And I had won second prize a few years before that. And I knew that many people had gone and placed third place or second place, and then they had gone back and won first place, like, I don't know, Joshua Bell, Rachel Barton Pine, you know, really big names had gone through this process, and I had won second. So I naively thought, oh, I'll go back and win it this time.
Sure.
Of course, that, you know, now I know better. That's kind of a ridiculous way to go to a competition. But I was so accustomed to winning the things that I entered that then when suddenly I didn't place at all when I went back, I didn't quite know how to situate that. It didn't really affect me much in an obvious way. But in hindsight, I look back. And I think that was just one of the key things that happened among many other things that were happening around the same time that disappointed me. And I didn't see that I didn't know how I was going to get better at my playing. I didn't think that practicing for more hours a day was going to work. I knew there was something elusive that I was missing. And so long story short, I did find later on what was missing, and that I got through the Alexander technique. We could talk about that later. But to answer your question about the spirituality, I grew up in a non-spiritual, non-religious household and didn't even have a concept of spirituality. But music for me really was my spiritual practice without knowing it. And I had a very, very deep connection to music through my violin, and it just was healing for me emotionally. I would sometimes go into the room, my bedroom, turn off the lights at night and just play my heart out, and it was very healing. And I felt that communicating with other people through music was the way I could easily communicate. I was not, I was very, very shy. It was hard for me to communicate verbally. Like doing an interview like this would have absolutely terrified me as a child. And so music was my spiritual practice unconsciously. But then when I was 19, I was introduced by the man who became my husband. He introduced me to just a spiritual way of looking at life. And it wasn't anything specific. It was a very universal way of just perceiving things differently. And I immediately understood it. It just made so much sense to me. And I'm like, oh, that's what I want. And that's what I've been looking for my entire life. And I've been looking for it through music. But now I don't need music anymore because I have spirituality. So I kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater at the time. I saw many years later, but it was the process I needed to go through. At that time, I didn't feel like I needed the violin anymore.
And that makes sense in some way. I mean, just when I was reading that, I was like, oh, it felt kind of unfortunate because, you know, you think, well, couldn't you have somehow, you know, it's like expressed even more deeply the violin at that point because you're more in touch with yourself and all of that. So I thought, well, there must be some other little piece of the puzzle there where it felt like it was just too much. And you had to kind of let that part, you know, kind of sit there for a while. But at the same time, again, coming full circle with your Alexander technique and all of that, it kind of made sense that you needed to go through that process to kind of look at those other factors that were troubling you, like the technique and maybe how you're feeling in your body when you're playing violin, just that feeling that something was missing, right?
And it's really where my attention took me. Mm-hmm. It's where my interest and my curiosity took me, because I had been around music, around the violin forever. You know, I wanted a violin when I was 2 and I got one when I was 4. And I was so single-mindedly focused on that violin for 19 years. And suddenly something else came along that completely shifted my outlook and captured my attention and my interest. So I got really interested in comparative religions and learning more about meditation, which I'd always been interested in personally, not in a formal way, but I did find some formal practices and I wanted to learn more about those things. And I was just fascinating fascinated. And so I just wasn't interested anymore in the violin and the musical world. I felt kind of like I'd done it all at that point, which of course is very far from the truth, but that's sort of what it felt like at that time. And so this novel new approach to life was just, and I fell in love. So the whole thing came together and then I got, you know, within a year. So there was a lot happening to me. I was young. I was wide-eyed and falling in love with a person and with spirituality together. So yeah, everything changed for me. But then, as I wrote about in the book, I, over the years, started to become less happy for a lot of reasons. And I kept my spirituality, but I was having all kinds of other things happen that just were, I was getting kind of miserable. And so that's when I found the Alexander technique, and it provided the missing link to my happiness, really embodying my spirituality, which I hadn't understood how to do until I found the Alexander technique, and then also filled in the gap in my violin playing. I never actually quit, but I did drop my solo career when I was 19, but I kept playing. And so then finding, you know, ways to play the violin with ease, and everything that you said before about, yes, it is absolutely possible to, you know, bring more of yourself to your music when you can embody it and bring your whole heart and soul and spirit to it. I found that much later, but the Alexander technique opened up the door for me to start exploring that.
Yeah. So you were talking about how, so you fell in love, and reading your bio, you had some kids, and just, it sounds like just over the course of, I'm not sure how many years, but starting to feel aches and pains. And it sounds like you tried a lot of different methods to get some help. And then how did you come across Alexander technique?
Well, interestingly, when I was at Indiana University, is the first time I came across it. I saw a flyer for a free lesson. So, you know, I was all for free things as a student.
Totally.
So, unfortunately, I really didn't like it. I was turned off by it. And then I didn't find it again until more than a decade later. And I had a friend who was into the Alexander technique, so I was a little more open to trying it again. So I tried it again and had a very good experience at a group demo, which is also free. And then I took the teacher up on a free private lesson, which unfortunately, again, was a really unpleasant experience for me. So I had two very negative experiences. And in the second one, I just was almost fainting in the lesson like three times. But, and it wasn't the fault of the teacher. It just wasn't for me at that time. And then my friend, when I had neck pain, she said, "Jennifer, I know you would love the Alexander technique. You really just have to try it one more time, and you just need to find the right teacher for you." And so I grumbled, and I did go to the doctor, the regular, I did regular medical treatment. I went to the chiropractor. Nothing helped my neck. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll try one more time. So it was pretty amazing, because this teacher opened up the door. And as soon as he opened up the door and I took one look at this teacher, I knew it was going to work. And it absolutely did, in amazing ways I never could have imagined. My neck pain was gone within a couple lessons, but everything started to feel amazing. I felt so good. And so I kept taking lessons, and I wanted to understand what it was about. So I ended up doing a teacher training for 3 years, and that's a longer story, but that's how I found it.
Wonderful. And how interesting that you had, kind of third time's the charm, right? And like you said, there wasn't necessarily anything wrong with those previous teachers or experiences. I'm sure now that you're a teacher yourself and you've had all this experience, you can probably look back on those experiences you had and be like, yeah, they did everything right. And, you know, but yeah, maybe it just wasn't the right rapport, the right timing for you, right? And how we always have to consider that timing factor is huge. And whether we're doing Alexander technique, working with our body, we're taking violin lessons, we're doing whatever, like, has to be the right teacher kind of at the right time, right?
Exactly. And I was just going to compare it like you said, to music teachers. Not every violin teacher is right for every violin student. And I can't imagine just, I mean, there are people who will, you know, grab a violin teacher out of, you know, go online and pick the first one there. Right. But that doesn't mean that's going to be the right teacher for that person. And so it usually does make sense to shop around a little bit for a music teacher before a person commits to them. And I guess I shopped around for an Alexander Technique teacher for 12 years, but did find the right one for me. And chemistry really is important.
Yeah. And I was curious too, because I imagine some people listening may not presently be experiencing any kind of pain, or at least they might not notice any tension. And so I'm wondering, with that very first experience when you just saw that flyer and you thought, oh, I'll give this a try. Like, I don't know if you were really experiencing anything in particular. And maybe if that was part of, it's like there's, yeah, part of maybe why that wasn't necessarily a good experience because you didn't necessarily need it, or yeah, I guess the broader question is can Alexander Technique help people who aren't necessarily experiencing any particular pain, but they just want to become more in touch or kind of get ahead of maybe problems that might come up down the road, postural issues or playing mm-hmm. issues?
Absolutely. The Alexander Technique taught by a good teacher is going to be able to help anybody. And that's a pretty bold statement, but it's my, well, I should qualify that. Anybody who's open to learning.
Yeah.
If someone's not open to learning something new, then Alexander Technique may or may not help them, but it's less likely to help them. And I guess I'd like to add also that I don't even remember who the first person who taught me was, but I do know now that I'm a teacher that that person really did not know what she was doing. And so it wasn't just that I had a bad experience as a student. I didn't have pain. I didn't have tension. I was enjoying my playing. I was successful. I didn't have any problems.
Yeah.
But I was curious. And if I had gone to a lesson taught by a skilled teacher who did know what they were doing and I connected with them, I would have absolutely loved it. And my life would have been very, very different. I love how my life is turning out, but it would have been really different. Yeah. If I had found the Alexander Technique with a good teacher when I was 19 or 18, whenever it was that I had that first experience. And then, things could have been really different. And so it is important to find a teacher that you click with, that you have the chemistry with. But, you know, just like a good violin teacher, you actually do need to have somebody who's qualified, who knows how to play the violin and knows how to teach it.
Right, so. Right. And even though maybe that first teacher that you experienced the Alexander Technique with wasn't as skilled or didn't have as much experience, I mean, I know for myself as a teacher, sometimes just looking back over some experiences that I had along the way with violin teachers that weren't really the right fit or weren't really the ideal match for me, it really helped inform just how I can be a better teacher. Sometimes we do need those experiences, and it's good that you came back around to it. But yeah, I can hear what you're saying where, gosh, I could have maybe sidestepped all of that tension and pain that I had along the way, 10 years later. But yeah, at the same time, to really experience that pain and tension so that you could really value what you did find as well. So
I have no regrets about, I shouldn't say no. I have a couple little regrets about things that happened in my life, but they're over and done with and there's nothing I could do about it now.
Absolutely.
So, onwards, right?
We all have a few of those.
Yes, we all have those probably. Yeah. But I don't have regrets about the path that I've been on. And a lot of it was really difficult. I mentioned some of it in my book, like getting pneumonia and losing all sense of purpose. I mean, there were dark times and we all go through difficulties. And, as artists, as musicians, those times, if we can learn how to use them, how to learn from them, how to grow from them, they just make us better artists. Because if you've never had any difficulties, and it's like it's hard to access those difficult emotions when you're playing music that requires them. And to be a great artist, to be a great musician, you really have to be able to feel viscerally with your whole self anything that a composer is putting into their music. And so we have to draw from being in touch with those feelings in ourselves. And one of the best ways, I think, is to have gone through some of it. I mean, we don't have to go through everything. We can also imagine, but it's really helpful in a paradoxical way if we've gone through hard emotions and really felt them in a personal way, and then we can connect with our composers and the music they wrote better.
That's a great point. And I think our society sort of values people who are youthful and, you know, this just like ever ending, you open up a magazine or something and it's all this anti-aging and, you know, just all of this. But especially as musicians, you know, there's that too, where it's like, oh, you've got to make your break, in, you know, by the time you're a teenager, and otherwise it's too late for you, and this sort of feeling. But it's like, I think about my younger students and even teenage students, where it's like we're exploring a piece and the emotions of a piece, and there's certain qualities that I think there's no way that this person could have actually experienced themselves, probably. A romantic section of the piece, and this is an 8-year-old or something. I mean, maybe they've kind of experienced that through a story or a movie that they saw. They felt a little bit of that kind of vicariously. So that's interesting and a nice reminder I mean, we have to live, right?
Yeah, accept things as they come.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's one of the most important things that I've learned from the Alexander technique, and that I try to share with my students, is that, I mean, the essence of the technique really is learning to notice what's happening to you in reaction to whatever's happening right now, internally and externally, and to catch how you're reacting mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, like with your whole self. How are you reacting to whatever it is? Are you reacting by tightening up or constricting, or do you have some kind of a fear, startle-based response? And if you can notice that that's happening, then you can also learn how to think in a way that lets go of that, maybe not instantly, but, you know, depending on what you're triggered by, what you're reacting to, you might not be able to let go of it instantly, but to not judge your reaction, and then to be able to let go gradually as much as you can, because to be able to express those feelings, and again, we're putting it into a musical context here, so to be able to express what you're feeling through your music so that you can be moved and then move your audience as a result, you have to have the skill and the understanding to notice what's happening to you and then be able to let it go so that the feelings can move through you instead of getting stuck or rejecting them. Yeah. And it sounds like a really complex process, but it's actually incredibly simple. And I mean, it's really, really simple. The way I teach it is different from how most people out there have probably encountered Alexander technique, and how I was taught it also, which was using touch. I don't use touch when I teach anymore, and I haven't been for many years. I've been exclusively online since 2018. And so I don't use touch to help a person, but I help a person recognize how they're reacting and how they're thinking to get the feelings in their body, like what's causing their pain or their injury or their performance anxiety, or just, you know, not feeling like they can do what they want with their instruments. So I can help them by looking at them, listening, and then help them let go of it. And they learn how to do the basics of that on the first day they work with me. It's actually really quick and really simple. Then it's a matter of practicing it in endless contexts.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And there's just so much that we can do without touching someone. I mean, everything that you're doing, creating more awareness in someone for themselves so they can do it themselves, right? That's kind of the point. I found that too, because I transitioned to being online and then exclusively online also like way before the pandemic here. And especially early on, people were going like, but how can you fix anyone's technique if you can't manually adjust their arm or put their finger down or move their bow? And personally, I always felt like those manual adjustments from different teachers along the way, a lot of them being, they were very jarring and kind of startling. I'm in the middle of my piece and then someone grabs my arm, you know, and says, does this, and the bow skids across the strings. I'm like, how is that helpful? And then how does that create in the student, whether it's a violin student or an Alexander Technique student, how does that really create an awareness in them where they could reproduce whatever that person was trying to show them at home when they're practicing on their own, you know? So that's wonderful that you found a way to sort of innovate that where you can also share it with more people and people around the world. And that's what I loved about being able to teach online too.
Yes. Oh, I'm so happy to hear your story. That's amazing. I think you're the only person I've ever come across who decided, you know, before the pandemic to teach and implement online. And, you know, I've typically thought that in my experience, it would be helpful to be able to touch a music student. But I totally hear what you're saying. So many music teachers are not trained in how to touch a student in a way that's actually helpful rather than manipulative.
Yeah.
And when it's a manipulative touch, that there's a kind of, they're imposing on the student, like, you should do this. It's supposed to be like this. And, you know, it can be very helpful and well-intentioned, of course. But I love to your point that that student then may not have as much of an understanding of how to get there on their own as if they were gently guided verbally and, you know, visually from you, just saying, I can just imagine it, right? So I think that's really exciting and very similar to what I do.
Well, and it's also, you know, we're thinking about different ages too. I mean, obviously a four-year-old is going to need someone's help. So in my case, it's a parent, but then that's training the parent to help the kid anyway, that they'll have, they'll have to help the kid during the week. So yeah, it kind of all works out pretty well most of the time. But no, sometimes touch is very helpful. But yeah, being mindful of what that touch feels like and getting into someone's personal space, you know, in a way that is appropriate, and maybe asking, is it okay that I touch your arm? I mean, those were things that I learned not until I did a yoga teacher training. Whereas, like, if you're going to go around your class and do manual adjustments, you better ask each student, you know, or maybe you'll have a lawsuit on your hands. But we don't really have that I've ever heard of in music lessons. And yeah, there are teachers out there just grabbing people's arms and twisting things all the time. And sometimes, you know, what could be harmful ways, I feel like, and certainly in my case, startling ways.
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons that I decided to go online with the Alexander Technique, which when I did it, there were literally less than a handful of people in the whole world, just like you. I'm sure there were very few people doing what you were doing at that time. Now, lots of people do it because they had to over the pandemic. But back then, especially Alexander Technique, which had been defined by most people by touch, it was pretty radical to go online, and I got a lot of unpleasant pushback from within my profession, which has changed over the years, thankfully. But the reason I decided to use my hands less and less is that, to your point, it's empowering for the student. When I'm looking at a student, listening to them, taking in the quality of their attention, their mindset, how they're moving, when I can take that in and meet them where they are visually and auditorily, it's like I can hear it as well, because I've had actually more than 8 years of extra training in how to teach this without touch. from my partner, Mio Morales. It's a specific form of Alexander technique called Primal Alexander. But I've always, like when I had my first lessons, I loved them. They were completely life-changing. The touch was non-manipulative and very gentle and really, really healing. But I didn't understand at all what was going on. And I didn't understand at all how to do it for myself. So I had the need to go back for those lessons again and again because it felt so good. I really wanted more of that. And I became dependent on those lessons to help me feel better. And at the time, I saw that happening and I didn't like it. But I didn't have an alternative at that time. I mean, I tried. I got all of Alexander's books from the library and educated myself and, you know, learned about what was behind it. But it still didn't help me in a practical way to be able to, you know, start healing and feeling great myself without a teacher in the room. So I wanted to empower my students down the road to know what to do for themselves when I wasn't around. I didn't want them to become dependent on me and my presence. And so this is the perfect medium for me when I work with students. And like you said, it's so nice to be able to work with people anywhere, all over the world. I have students, like off the top of my head, I can think of China, Syria, Iran, Ireland, France, Germany, England, and of course, Canada and the United States. It's fun for me to connect to so many different kinds of people. And yet we're all the same. We all have the same mind and body and emotions. And it's just endlessly fascinating. I love it.
It just makes the world smaller, kind of in a good way. But then there's also sort of these little cultural things that it's fun to learn about, just sort of, you know, in passing with people who are around the world in different cultures. So. Yeah. I loved how you just, when you first started describing Alexander, you talked about that awareness and mindfulness. And that is different than, I think, how I've thought about Alexander, again, thinking more just kind of physical, you know, and of course there is that physical component, but maybe we can just take a step back and give like just an overview for someone who's never even heard of Alexander technique, sort of what maybe traditionally it entails. And then, of course, we're going to love to hear more about exactly how you're shaping it and working with your clients.
Paradoxically, the way I teach without touch is how Alexander himself used to teach in the beginning.
Oh, interesting.
And so the story in a nutshell is that Frederick Matthias Alexander, who was born in 1869, a long time ago, developed hoarseness on stage when he was pursuing his acting career. And vocal specialists and doctors, speech therapists, nobody found anything wrong with his physical body. So they couldn't help him. And yet he was determined to have, you know, to become an actor, to have a successful career acting. And so he was basically left to his own devices. And thankfully, he was very determined and very intelligent, and he decided, or he figured out that if he was getting hoarse on stage to perform, and he wasn't getting hoarse in other areas of his life, he could speak normally, there must be something he was doing to himself in the way he was going about speaking that was causing him to get hoarse. So he figured, well, I must be doing this to myself, so I should be the one to be able to stop doing whatever it is and fix this problem. So he got mirrors and washed himself, and the story goes that it was actually for quite a few years, but he did figure it out. And basically, he recognized that he had been thinking in a certain way, like reacting to the situation of being on stage and performing and wanting to emote and get his message across, you know, like we do as musicians. You really want your audience to love what you're doing and you want them to get it and have a great experience. Well, he realized that the way he was thinking those things was causing him to get tight. And that excess tension in him was blocking the free expression of his art. And so he solved the problem by learning how to think in a specific way that allowed him to open up and express instead of blocking it. So he solved the hoarseness and became celebrated as an actor. People started flocking to him to learn how to get a voice like that. So he started teaching. And then he started realizing that the problem he thought was unique to him, we all do it. Not just actors, not just artists, every single person on the planet has, I mean, it's the way we are designed. It's the way the body and the mind work together that when you think a certain way, your body reflects it. And if you think differently, your body will reflect it differently. So you might as well start getting curious about how you're thinking and what the effects of your thoughts are. The problem is most of them are unconscious. We're not aware of them. So we need to have a system that helps us to pay better attention and get curious and experiment and explore what are we actually doing to ourselves in how we're thinking that is causing literal pain in the body. Maybe not just hoarseness, but you know, diseases can be caused. Lots of musician industry, injuries, carpal tunnel, neck pain, back pain, shoulder pain. Students come to me with those problems all the time. And I don't work on the neck. I don't work on the carpal tunnel wrist. You know, I get curious and, you know, have a conversation with them. And we start exploring, well, what else is going on when you're feeling this in your body? What are you thinking? What are you feeling? And you know, just by observing and getting curious, a person can change everything. I always think it's pretty miraculous how, you know, many of the things, just about everything that we might think is a physical problem is not really a physical problem. It's a whole person problem that manifests in the body in some people, manifests as performance anxiety at other times. I mean, but the basic problem is the same in everyone. It's a whole person reaction to something in fear that then gets stuck in the body and causes constriction. And then energy can't flow, healing can't happen. And we get in our own way without even realizing it because we're blaming our shoulder or our wrist or whatever. Which makes sense when you don't understand how holistic everything is. But
yeah, and then people go to such extremes to try and fix their body with surgeries and injections and all sorts of things.
Yeah, it's so sad for me to watch when that happens. And, you know, obviously some surgeries are absolutely essential and thank God for, you know, modern medicine. But I've also seen so many times when a person is really suffering and is not open to exploring something a little different and just wants to go to the doctor, and the doctor sends them to the surgeon and the surgeon puts them on the table, and you know, their physical problem might be solved, and hopefully it is, but there can be side effects. There can be real risks to surgeries, like really devastating risks to surgeries. And it doesn't really get to the root of the problem that caused the issue to begin with, which is always holistic and always includes something about, I guess I shouldn't say always. I mean, if you step on a nail, there's a nail. The problem is not really emotional. You stepped on a nail, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's always more to an issue than meets the eye. And it's all too easy to blame a physical pain on the body and think that it's just a physical issue that is unrelated and unconnected to everything else, which just, it can't be, because we're whole beings and you can't separate parts.
Yeah. Well, I think even just so many tensions and pains caused by, you know, like a postural issue where someone, you know, some certain muscle group is contracted, another is overstretched and sort of overburdened. And then that carries on for weeks or months or years. And then at some point, someone's really in pain and they go, well, I guess I've, you know, got to do something about this. And yeah, maybe it's surgery, maybe it's whatever. But then if we go back to, well, why were you slumped over 10 years ago and you're always walking around kind of slumped over and now it's created this neck issue or whatever, back issue.
Right.
And it's like, well, someone who's slumped over isn't going to be someone who's like filled with joy. Like you think about a little kid on Christmas morning and it's like, yay, look at all these presents. They're not slumped over. You know, it's going back to, again, kind of what you're talking about with where our mind state is or where our just our whole being is. Right. And so, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I don't know, like as these issues go on and on and on, it might be hard to kind of trace it back to whatever that feeling was that caused us to be slumped over and in that posture. But yeah, it's like the body has reacted. And that feels very tangible to me. I mean, everyone kind of recognizes body language, you know, someone with their arms crossed or someone with a furrowed brow or someone who's slumped over or the opposite, someone who's standing up nice and tall and they look very confident. And we all kind of, even if we're not thinking about it too hard, we are reading body language and we're noticing and reflecting on how we, you know, how we think other people are feeling based on that. So yeah, it doesn't Absolutely. Have to be like kind of this new age thing or anything, right?
Right. I think we all know this unconsciously, if not consciously, and yet we don't realize how important it is. I was just going to say something about what you said that was so interesting. I just lost my train of thought. Ah, it's so frustrating.
I'm sure we'll come back. But I found it fascinating.
I know what it was.
Actually. Go for it.
Talking about how somebody, like an adult, let's say an adult like us, we might start to notice some pains, but it's been building up over a long time. And so it's hard to know what actually caused it. I think especially professionals I'm thinking of immediately because they've usually been playing for a really long time. And for example, someone in an orchestra who's been there for a couple decades, maybe has always had a little niggling pain, but didn't really pay much attention to it and had to keep performing, had to keep rehearsing, you know, every day, every night, every weekend. And over a long period of time, that pain might have gotten a little worse, a little worse, a little worse until maybe they went to get massages, went to get chiropractic or, you know, have a physical, you know, manipulative treatment that would kind of help temporarily. But then, of course, they have to go back for more of that. But at some point, and I'd say most from my experience and talking with lots and lots of people in orchestras, most people are suffering from physical pain, and most people are loath to admit it. And I think there's even research, there are research studies that's done on that. So I'm not making that up. But I think when a person gets to the point where they actually have to stop, like maybe they need to get a rotator cuff surgery, which are common in musicians, right? Especially violinists, sadly. But they might not realize that they started feeling that way decades earlier and did nothing about it. And like you said, that it was connected to a state of mind or an emotional issue that was going on. And lots of musicians are taught in ways that are actually not really natural to their bodies. And there's stress and goal-oriented thinking that takes them out of that joy and immediate pleasure of what they're doing in the practice room. So it's all together. But the really, really good news about the way I'm teaching this is that nobody even has to remember where the origin of the problem was or why it happened. All that matters is right now. So when a student comes to me, they often tell me the stories that they remember. And of course, I'm interested and I listen, but I know that it doesn't really matter what happened way back in high school or, you know, in college when that horrible teacher did that horrible thing. You know, those things are important, but it's not like psychotherapy or something where you, you know, dig up the old stories and you analyze them. We hardly do any of that. In fact, we don't have to do any of it. If we do any of it, it's because the student really wants to talk about it, which is fine. But as far as I'm concerned, everybody shows up how they are right now in the moment. And all that really matters is what they're experiencing right now and what they're thinking right now. And then I can help them shift to thinking a different way right now so they can change the direction that they're going in. So instead of over decades continuing in this negative spiral of increasing pain and discomfort and maybe unhappiness, instead of continuing in that direction overall, they can pause and they can get curious, notice how they've been thinking that caused discomfort, and then stop doing that. And then do what we call constructive thinking, which is a very specific way to shift how, you know, shift the mindset. And instantly, I'm not exaggerating, it's like instantly everything changes direction and something lets go. Then with practice, and I give my students what we call awareness etudes, which is just for a couple minutes in the morning, in the evening, or wherever, whenever, twice a day, they're practicing these specific, very simple thought etudes, awareness etudes, maybe with a simple arm movement to integrate some movement. They do that twice a day, every day, and very soon they are aware that they're going in a better direction. They start to feel better in their bodies. They start to feel happier. Things just get easier. They realize how they've been rushing around constantly under stress. They get to slow down and realize how that helps everything. I was just talking with a student yesterday who is, she is a homeschooling mother, and she's worked with me for maybe a week, 2 weeks maximum. And actually not even with me, I have a self-study course that people start with. So she hadn't even had any contact with me personally yet, except in a little workshop about a month ago, but that was the group. Yeah, I didn't really work with her. Sure. So after 1-2 weeks maximum, she was telling me when I met with her yesterday how she's noticing so much changing in her that it's actually influencing how she's working with her son. And so that's interesting, you know, for violin teacher, music teacher, is like, she's not trying to be different around her son, but she's paying attention to how she's thinking and moving differently. And it's having an automatic effect on the people around her and her son. And children are so sensitive. They pick up on everything. So when the teacher is taking care of herself, then the student picks up on that modeling. And things get easier for both the teacher and the student. And it's just amazing to me how quickly that can happen if someone is just open to learning something new and does the awareness etudes.
That's amazing. Everything that you're saying is, to me, is sort of reflecting to some of my hypnotherapy training experience, and particularly the part where we were doing NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. And there was one particular process where, you know, rather than kind of like having to rehash all the baggage and all of this, it's like just sort of touching in with that feeling or that memory, and then recognizing that it was there for a purpose, and sort of almost like thanking it for being there and showing us that, but then transforming it by getting to basically like, what's your core outcome? What did it want for you? Actually, we can kind of turn that around and find that in the moment, it's just we're kind of carrying that baggage because we actually want something that's very positive. Oftentimes, it can kind of take someone through that process and get to like universal love and oneness and, you know, something actually more spiritual and holistic. But yeah, just how, as helpful as it can be to sort of revisit some of that trauma or, you know, maybe whatever caused these issues to lodge in the body or in the psyche or in the mental state, that it's just us right now at the same time. Like, how are we feeling right now, and what can we be aware of right now, and even how that can transform, just like you're saying, like in an instant, that could transform just by sort of shining some light on it and being aware of how we are, what our pattern is, how we're thinking, how we're standing, how we're holding our violin. Yeah.
And I love how you were saying that those habits that we have, you know, they're not negative. They're not bad habits. I don't like to think of bad habits. habits were formed for a good reason. There's always a good reason that we do what we do. And unfortunately, a lot of the habits that we have that were useful at some point in time, maybe we did need to protect ourselves in a certain situation.
Yeah.
And then took on that protective reaction, that the way that we hold ourselves, we've kept doing it, even though the original reason that we were protecting ourselves isn't there anymore. And now that habit is actually no longer helpful, and it's actually getting in the way. So, but a lot of these things are really deep. And I think it's really helpful to remember that there was a good reason for it, whatever it was, even if you never remember it. And it's nobody's fault,
yeah,
right? And when somebody has an injury, it's not their fault. I mean, maybe they were over practicing or overworking or not eating well or not sleeping enough and being driven. It's not helpful to look back and get angry at ourselves, you know, for what we did. And there are good reasons for it and maybe misunderstanding of what was actually helpful. But again, it's like right now, what is presenting, it's like the past is gone. It's over. And it's truly gone. There are memories in the neurology of our systems that are real, like the neurons connect and fire and wire together in a certain way. And that's still doing that today. But right now, we can actually do something different to change the neurology, to change our habits. And that just takes awareness and motivation, desire, and then enough desire to actually practice what works to change the habits and do things differently. But it's actually not hard. I think a lot of people think that changing habits is difficult. And it is and it isn't, but I think people aren't quite aware of how easy it can be. I mean, Alexander said you can change the habits of a lifetime in an instant if you use your brains.
Yeah.
and it does take discipline. You know, you can change it in an instant by doing that mode of constructive thinking that I mentioned. People learn that on the first day, but then it needs to be practiced because it's a skill. Like any skill, like if you want to learn how to play octaves in tune, you have to practice that. And if you want to learn to notice your reactions and do something different, you have to practice that. It's not hard. It's actually easy.
Absolutely. Yeah, I like the idea of just, yeah, being able to change in an instant. I always think of like if you are always taking this one road to the grocery store or whatever, and then someone says, oh, do you know this faster way? It's just over here and it's really beautiful. There's like this gorgeous little farmhouse you drive by or whatever, you know. Oh, no, I've never heard of that way before. Oh, check it out. It's 2 minutes faster, whatever. You go, okay, I'll check it out. Are you ever going to go the old way again? Maybe not.
It's so funny you mentioned that because in my book, I have exactly that example.
Oh, how funny.
Not with the grocery store, but going through a jungle to get to the other side of the jungle and always taking the long route and not even being aware of it. So, yeah. And then someone else comes along and says, do you realize that's the long way? But when you're being mindless, the brain will take you on the old path, even though it's longer and not as pretty,
yeah,
because it's habit. And so we do actually have to become conscious and choose over and over again. Okay, I don't want to do the old way. I'm going to go this way.
Yeah.
And it feels uncomfortable at first because it's different. And it requires the brain to reorganize to do something new. And so being mindless and doing the old way, even if it's unhealthy, seems easier, even if it's actually harder and takes more energy. But it's sort of like an addict who knows that taking drugs or drinking is bringing them to an earlier grave. You know, they know intellectually that it's unhealthy. I think every addict would know that. And yet the habit is so strong. And in the moment, it feels good. So they're ruled by their feelings instead of, you know, a conscious, intelligent choice. And the feelings win unless there's, you know, there's a real system in place and a lot of support and a lot of understanding and logic using all our resources to be able to change something like that.
That's the thing when some of these patterns have been our coping mechanism for dealing with something, right? That can be hard to let go of. Do you ever find, sometimes I have adult students and they're experiencing pain or tension and we're looking at their technique and how their posture is and all of these things. And oftentimes, you know, there's little things that we can fix, but then I start to ask them, well, how was your week this week? Were you doing a lot of, I don't know, yard work or housework, or are you carrying heavy things, or how are you sleeping? You know, I'm just asking all these questions. And then it's like the whole dam breaks, you know, and they start talking about, oh, well, you wouldn't believe what I had to do. And this family drama came up and I was carrying all of this heavy stuff. And then I didn't sleep well for 5 nights in a row. Mm-hmm. You go like, well, we'll keep looking at how it's going with violin here and let's, you know, make sure that you're doing this and that. But I can't help but think, like, it's not just something that we can fix with violin because it's not just about violin, right? This is an all-encompassing, like, this week was rough on this person. But it's interesting where, you know, maybe in the moment they'll recognize, well, yeah, that kind of makes sense. But then sometimes they just want to hold so strong to just, but I really do think when I was practicing, I felt this little twinge that that's what happened and it was violin related. And go like, maybe. Or maybe that's just like, that was the last straw. Yeah. After all this other stuff had built up so much. So how do you deal with people who maybe they're resistant to sort of letting things go, or who just want to hold strong to some of these patterns? I'm sure that comes up sometimes.
Absolutely. And first of all, I want to say your students are really lucky to have you.
Oh, thank you.
They are, because you have such a bigger perspective on what's going on, and to ask them what was happening to your week, and you're making the connection. And I'm sure when you make the connection, you're also helping a lot of them see the connection too.
A lot of them do. Sometimes, you know, when we're in it and we're really stressed and they're just fighting to kind of keep going. Yeah, it's so funny to just see how strongly people sometimes want to hold on to even the stuff that's causing them pain. That's their journey, you know. That's where we're at.
And it feels familiar, and it also it's hard to step out of that sometimes, because stepping out of it makes them feel like they're not themselves. It's like that tension that they carry around is part of their personality, and without it, they wouldn't know who they are. And I mean, it sounds extreme when I put it that way, but it's actually really what it's about underneath. And I think what I do too, because you asked me, you know, what happens, what do I do if I come up, if there's a student who's really resistant to that idea? I think it doesn't happen so much because from the very beginning, I mean, I'm not teaching violin lessons. I don't teach violin. I teach all kinds of musicians about a holistic way to be and live and make music with their whole self. So at the outset, unfortunately, many people come to me as a last resort. And I do say unfortunately, because a lot of people tell me, you know, I've been following you for years and I've been reading your things on Facebook and getting your emails. And I, you know, I've tried this and I tried that and I tried this and I'm about to quit my instrument. And I thought, I'll just try one more thing. So I thought I'd reach out to you. And I'm delighted when they reach out to me. But I always think, gosh, I wish you had reached out 2 years ago. You could have avoided a lot of the suffering that you've been through. So anyway, whenever a person comes to me, like I said before, I have self-study courses. I do it that way because I found that I was, you know, needing to repeat myself a lot about basics, and kind of philosophy and principles and all that to my new students. And I thought it would be much easier to just have a video and they can learn from the course. And then when we meet one-on-one, it's really personal.
Yes.
I mean, very individual. It's about what they personally need. But in the soft study courses, it's all about helping them to make the connections between the everyday life and the everyday approach that they have to their daily activities, like brushing their teeth, walking the dog, doing the dishes, making the connection that you are the same person in those activities as you are when you pick up your violin or your oboe or whatever the instrument is. You are your primary instrument. I like to say that a lot. It's like the whole self, the mind, body, emotions, spirit, whatever you think is you, that's the you that you bring to every activity. And that's the primary instrument that needs to be looked at. And you need to get curious about that and learn, okay, what are my habits? What do I typically do when I grab a glass from the cupboard to get a glass of water? Am I typically in a rush? Am I typically mindless thinking about something else? Am I, you know, frustrated that I have to drink water and I don't like water? You know, I actually, a lot of people don't. I mean, it's those kinds of things that people need to start observing better about themselves, because that's the kind of observation we need to be able to do when we're wanting to play scales in tune. You need to develop that self-observer, that self-witness attitude that's also, I mean, it has a healthy detachment to it, and there's also no criticism. Like, that's one of the hardest things for people to learn, is to be just accepting of whatever is right now. So if I play a scale and the C sharp is out of tune, not to say, oh God, when am I ever going to be able to play this in tune? It's like, right. I had it yesterday. Why is it out of tune today? I thought I fixed that. You know, the typical things that we do to ourselves, we don't just do it when we're playing scales. We do it in everyday life. So, and we need to learn to not do that, because if you're reacting to playing out of tune, you get tight. When you get tight, it's harder to hear things accurately, and it's harder to think about how to fix something in an efficient way that works. So, like, the whole system has to be working optimally to be able to learn and improve and express the music that we're making. These are holistic things that are about the primary instrument. It's about how you think, how you move, how you feel in yourself. And we are practicing that all day long, whether we know it or not. We're practicing how we use ourselves when we get up in the morning. What's our attitude towards the day? We practice it when we get our instrument out of the case. We think that that moment is not as important as when we start making sound. No, we need to pay attention to what we're doing when we're opening the case, when we're rosining the bow, when we're walking over to the music and it's not there. Where's the music? I can't find it. How do we react? It's like, you react like, I only have half an hour to practice. I can't believe I am not finding my music. I'm wasting my time. You know, that kind of thinking is going to make the practice session harder, because we're bringing unnecessary tension to what we're doing and we're not even aware of it. So I think that's mostly what my work is about, is helping people to see things differently, to understand that we're practicing all day long, and we can't expect to suddenly be able to be all happy and easy and effortless when we're on stage if we haven't practiced that way. And we can't practice with our violin that way if we don't live that way.
I love that. I love that, because especially, I mean, all instruments, but violin and the bowed strings are so physical, and they require so much of our body, and not to mention our ears and our mind. Can't plunk a key and there's the right note. It's just like everything we have to work for, right? And so, yeah, if we're carrying all this tension, I had this image when you were talking about someone trying to make their way through a crowd, and it's like they're getting bumped and they're almost knocked down and, you know, trying to make their way through. And it's kind of like all those other people are like the different thoughts that we're just bombarded with constantly, or, and not just thoughts, but just day-to-day life stuff, right? That's coming up. And how we're just always, you know, kind of flinching and reacting and building that tension. Yeah. So then we come to our practice room and go like, okay, now let's just, like you said, be chill and be relaxed and play beautifully. It's like, how is that supposed to work? That makes no sense at all.
That's really.
Yeah. So they do this, the self-study course. And then I love that, by the way. They are getting kind of into your world and they can reflect, you know, throughout their life. And then they get to the point where they're going to work with you in a session. So what's your first steps there working with someone?
So usually the first time I meet in person or online, I call that in person, live with a person. The first time we meet, I really want to check in and see how they've been doing with the self-study course and to kind of do some of the awareness etudes that they learned on their own, just so I can give them a little feedback. And so I know where they are with that to make sure that they're, I don't want to say doing it right, but so that they've understood the approach and they're able to kind of do that for themselves. And almost always, you know, a person really does get it because it is really simple and natural to us. We're just learning to be conscious about something that we already know how to do that we've never done consciously before. So almost always a person can do it. And then I just give some suggestions to maybe enhance the effects a little bit or make it a little easier or clearer. So I'm helping them refine what they've already learned in the self-study course. And then for the rest of the session, and really it's led by the student and what they're most interested in. So a person might have pain. And so I talk to them about how they can work with themselves to help with the pain by thinking differently. And by observing and having that different mindset, and then, you know, occasionally with some, you know, physical things that they can do for themselves. Or they might have performance anxiety. And this happened just yesterday with a student where the student talked about getting nervous in her lessons with her teacher. And so I actually, you know, worked with her in real time. I said, okay, so Laura, or whatever her name was, right? Laura, can you get out your violin and play for me? You know, so I triggered her performance anxiety on purpose. And I said, don't worry, you don't have to play for me. But here's how we can work with it right now, because she was actually feeling the performance anxiety there with me. And so it was really fun to actually, friend for both of us, I must say. She got really nervous, but I just worked through the system, you know, with her. You know, asking her questions like, where do you feel that in your body right now? What's happening right now? What do you notice? It's like, oh, my heart's beating. Oh, okay. So be with that for a moment. And what else are you noticing? Usually when we're uncomfortable, we want to ignore it, deny it, run away from it, not feel it, and fix it.
Right.
So we were doing anything but that yesterday. We were just being with it, just observing and not judging. And there's a process that I teach to do that, that then gradually brings her to an experience of ease in her body so that she could actually feel comfortable. And she knew what she was doing to elicit that feeling in herself of more ease and comfort. And I'm really curious to hear back from her, because a few hours later, she was actually going to have a lesson with her teacher. And I was so excited to hear that. I was like, you get to go try this out in real life just a couple hours before you forget it.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that's kind of the types of things we might do. You know, somebody else might have a strong desire to play their instrument. That happened last week with somebody. And then we actually worked on how she was lifting her instrument and placing it, because there was a tremendous amount of tension and how she gripped between her shoulder and her jaw when she was gripping the instrument. So we needed to look at that, and I helped her undo a lot of that tension with a process that I teach. So it's very, very individual, you know, when it's one-on-one like that. And basically, a person, I have two ways that a person can start working with me. Typically, there's either, you know, a 5 or 6 week introductory program, which then has one, it includes one or two private coaching sessions, like what I just described. Or a lot of people just want to dive in and do a full coaching program with me, which is usually 6 months. But everybody in either program starts with the same level one self-study course and has a first session that, you know, pretty much sounds like what I just described, unless it's a 6-month coaching client. And then I do a longer kind of VIP session where we look at different life aspects and different categories like home environment and, you know, all kinds of different things about the whole life. I don't usually do that in the interim programs, but yeah, so that's how the teaching works. And in all of my programs, there's a group component. And so I have a regular membership. We meet with live classes every week, twice. And it's kind of like a martial arts class where I have people there who've been doing it for years, along with the newbies, the white belts, who don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. But once they've done a couple of weeks of the self-study, then they can integrate seamlessly into the group program. And some people, you know, aren't able to make the live classes. Everything's recorded, so nobody actually has to come to the group classes, but it's always nice to have the community and master classes where I work with people in front of the group. And yeah, it's really fun.
That support of people feeling like, oh, it's not just me doing this. We've got this little community and everyone's in it and becoming more aware. And
we have challenges that we do in the membership where, like we have a topic of the month. I think we did performance anxiety once. We did pain and physical stuff for another month. Right now we're talking about what I call the silver period, which is the time after a performance. Like, so you don't have a letdown. Or you're not like worrying about how you sounded, how the concert went. Like, what do you do in that time after? So we're devoting a whole month to what can you do after things, after a concert, after a practice session, after something happened in your personal life. You know, it's all these, the time after, that's important to pay attention to. Yeah. Usually I pay much attention to the period before, which I call the golden period, but there's also a silver period afterwards. And so we get detailed into how are you taking care of yourself in every way after or before an event. But no matter whether a person is, you know, a beginner or has been doing, you know, playing forever, it's so fun to be in a group because I have all levels together. Like I have a 70-year-old beginner cellist in my group, along with somebody recently who was teaching at one of the top music conservatories in the world. They're in the same class. It was so much fun.
That's great.
And they love it because it's not about what they can do with their instruments, their musical instruments. It's noticing and realizing that we're all the same. We have the same thoughts as we're about to go on stage. And we have the same fears and anxieties, and there's a lot of imposter syndrome and there's self-doubt and, you know, all these things. We all have them to some degree or another. You know, some people don't have much performance anxiety, but they have other issues. So when you have a group with enough people in it, you can always relate to something that's going on. And I just really enjoy having the different instruments and different skill levels and just having a big variety and seeing. We have a lot of fun exploring ourselves together.
Oh, that's wonderful. So we'll wrap up here shortly, but I was just wondering if you had maybe just a little exercise that people could do if they're just listening and they want to get a little bit more into this, they're curious about it, and they want to become more aware of maybe how they're approaching their instrument as they're practicing.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I usually start with, I kind of alluded to it before, but we can just, you know, go into it a little bit again now. You know, you, me, everybody listening right now, we can just take a moment and bring our attention back to ourselves. So if you're listening, if you're driving, maybe keep your eyes open.
Keep your eyes on the road.
Actually, almost always when I work with people, I'm encouraging them to do these etudes with their eyes open, because we want to connect a state of relaxation and ease in the body. We want to be able to do that when we're engaging with the world. So it's maybe a little different from most meditation, for example, where people kind of close out the world and close their eyes. So we have the eyes open. And so right now, if you can bring your attention to doing a bit of a body scan and just notice what you're feeling. Like, what's the body delivering? What are you? I mean, I'm talking right now, and as I'm talking and paying attention to that, I'm noticing a little tension in the sides and back of my neck as I'm speaking. And yet, as I'm paying attention, I notice I start to breathe a little bit differently. And I'm noticing how I'm holding my hands, and there's a little tension in my arms. So I'm not trying to change it. This is an important point. This is just an observation where we're doing a little inventory, like what's actually happening right now. We don't usually do that. We don't usually just take a moment to do nothing else other than to get curious about what we're actually experiencing without judging it or trying to make it go away, trying to make it change. So if you notice something particular showing up in your body right now, can you now get curious about what else is showing up in your body? Is there another place in your body that's speaking to you? Whether that's maybe a little tension or pain or discomfort, or maybe there's a place in your body that feels fine, or that's just quiet, where nothing much is happening. And even if somebody's listening right now who has a lot of chronic pain or feels pain all over, which sometimes happens, unfortunately, no two places in the body ever feel exactly the same. So you want to get curious, if that's the case for you listening. If you're feeling a lot of pain, is there a place that you can notice the pain and then compare it to a different place that has pain? And can you get curious about whether there's another place in your body that has just a little less, just a tiny little bit less discomfort? And this is a practice we call IMA. It's created by my partner, Mio Morales, who's created the system of Primal Alexander. This is the practical tools that I teach. And so you want to start where you are, getting curious, but also recognizing that there's always going to be a place in you that feels a little better than where your attention was first drawn. If where you were first drawn was painful or just, you know, uncomfortable, get curious. I keep saying curious because this kind of curiosity is the key. Get curious about whether there's another place in you that's a little different. It's a little less uncomfortable. And if you're lucky enough to feel lots of places of ease, which actually you get better at by practicing this, you start noticing more and more places that are okay. You want to keep shifting your attention with curiosity to finding another place of ease, relative ease. Okay. So we call this IMA, which means now in Japanese. And this is actually like, it's a pre-awareness etude, where you're just developing the skill of being present and what we just did. You're present, you're curious, you're noticing what's happening right now, and you're learning to shift your attention. And you're learning to get curious about places that are a little easier than the first place or just another easy place, right? So once you can do that, then there is the first awareness etude that I teach that, you know, anybody is welcome to go to YouTube, to my channel, where I actually teach that. It's a public, you know, YouTube video that it would take too long to teach it right now, but anybody can go to my channel and just look up my name, and it's called The Cycle. So you just search The Cycle, Jennifer Roy Frankeli, and it should pop up. Actually, I changed the name of that video. But anyway, there are two videos like that. So one of them will pop up.
We can always get a link and put it in the show notes too. So
that's where you start. And you start to cultivate this ability to link up how you're thinking with how you're feeling, and then get your brain to filter for more ease. And what you focus on, you get more of. So you want to get really good at focusing on what's already working, what's feeling good, And then you'll get more of that experience with repetition. And this may not seem like it has much to do with playing the violin, but it really has everything to do with playing the violin, because if you practice this systematically, like twice a day, that's what I tell my students, twice a day, or you can do it as a warm-up before you play your instrument. Do the cycle as a warm-up, and it is the best warm-up I know, because you become integrated in a different way, and you start noticing what's working, and you bring automatically more of an experience of ease to the first things you do with your instrument, and your practice session will get easier if you do this. Guaranteed. There is like no way it cannot get easier if you take just the 2 minutes to do the cycle beforehand. And it can seem like it takes a long time, but it's really only 2 minutes once you learn it. And I've had so many hundreds of people tell me that just by learning the cycle and doing that before they practice, their whole practice session gets better. And when they stick with it over time, they're other things in their life start getting better. It's pretty amazing, because that's only the very first of many, many awareness etudes that I teach. But it, in itself, it has a really powerful effect on the people who are curious and want to learn.
Yeah. And the exercise you took us through, just noticing places that are more easy than that initial spot we might have fixated on. How beneficial that is, just in kind of broadening that perspective. I can just think of people who, you know, once they're, it's like they're so enmeshed in their story and just everything that's going on with them. So yeah, everything feels painful, or everything feels hard, or, you know, everything's not going well. And then we look, well, what about this? What about that? And then how quickly that can shift things, where it's like, oh, well, actually the bigger picture isn't as bad as we thought. And that maybe just gives a little bit of an opening where they can start to shift everything.
Yeah. It really does have very broad implications. Okay. And you know, we here, and probably the people listening who are able to listen to this podcast, we're very privileged, you know, in comparison to a lot of people in the world who are suffering terribly. And it is helpful. I find it personally helpful to always remember how lucky we are and how many things really are working. Even, you know, we can have terrible events happen too, but when you look at the big picture, most of us are just so fortunate. And so this is like, you know, learning EMA and the cycle is like a microcosm, where it's actually really just about right now in the body. So sometimes that's even easier to access, because it's right here, right now. And I don't have to imagine, you know, the people on the other side of the world who are in the middle of a civil war or something. Yeah. It's just, there's a civil war going on inside of each of us. And we have to be more and more aware of what we're doing to ourselves. Also, if we want to change anything in this broader world, I firmly believe that each one of us has to do this kind of work first. We have to, you know, start realizing how we are hurting ourselves, and we're at war with ourselves. And this is a very easy, quick way to start doing that. And you can shift your whole perspective, but also how you feel in your body, really pretty quickly. And then you bring a different attitude and a different self to the world around you. And that absolutely has a ripple effect.
Yeah.
So I think there are a lot of implications to this little simple thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. We can feel kind of so helpless to make a difference in, you know, the big wide world and just everything that's going on. But it's really up to us to start with ourselves. And yeah, how can we be kinder to ourselves, more compassionate with ourselves, present ourselves in the world where, you know, we can be compassionate to others. And it's just our little circle, you know, but like you're saying, that has a ripple effect. So yeah.
And you never know who's going to be affected.
Yeah.
It's like even the tiny little things that we think don't really matter that we do, later we might find out that it changed somebody's life.
Yeah, you just never know.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times musicians, especially professional musicians, can wonder if what we're doing is worth it sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who might not be musicians and might think, oh, music is frivolous, or it's a luxury, or it's not a real profession, right?
Right. So, we all get that.
We know it is, but but I think, you know, there are musicians who might have some doubts sometimes, professional musicians who might doubt that what they're doing actually is helpful for the world. And I think we need to stop worrying about that, because you know, if we really are paying attention to ourselves and growing and learning how to be more at peace in ourselves, and then being able to transmit that through sound, that's a pretty magical thing. And we have no idea where those sound waves are going to end up and how they're going to influence the people who take in that information in that way. You never know who's in the audience, and you never know what they've been through that day. You never know what your few notes might do to change the rest of their day or their lives. We have no idea, but the best we can do is what we just said, is like, take care of yourself and bring your best self through whatever you do, and you can't go wrong.
Well, beautiful. Well, thank you so much. So tell us a little bit about your book.
So the book is called Make Great Music with Ease: The Secret to Smarter Practice, Confident Performance, and Living a Happier Life. And it's available through Amazon. You know, eventually down the road, I'll probably have them available on my website, but that's not going to be for a while. Right now, they're exclusive to Amazon. And yeah, it's been quite a journey to write this book. And I can't tell you how happy I am to see it finally out there. It's, you know, there's a lot to it. It's about the challenges musicians face. That's part one of the book. Part two is about my journey as a musician, and then finding the Alexander technique and changing my life. And then part three is the practical section that will be, you know, practically useful to anybody who reads it. There are things you can try out and do. And there's actually a free video training that goes along with the book that people can sign up for, and lots of PDF materials, bonus materials that come with the book too, like practice, I think it's a, what did I call it? Practice success worksheet, a basic skills. I don't remember what they are. There's so many in there. there's a lot of value that is extra to the book that people just can sign up for, and then they automatically get that too. And those are important, especially the video training, because I'm teaching the actual thing that we did today, EMA, and then the cycle, and just talking about how it all integrates. So it's more, you know, one-on-one. It's easier to learn something from a video, I think, than reading it in a book. So I wanted to give that angle as well. So I'm very excited about it, and I hope people really enjoy it.
Okay, congratulations. Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to get a big project like that out to the world, right?
Ugh, it's huge. I still can't even quite believe it. I look at the book and I pick it up and I can actually feel it. Like, it exists. It's real. I first started thinking about writing this more than a decade ago, but I totally was not ready to write this. And then I tried again maybe 3-4 years ago, and I got sidetracked by other life events that were unavoidable. So I dropped it for a while. So this was actually my third attempt, and I was determined to make it work. And I think it took me, it's been about a year and a half or so, you know, hours a day writing, and then, you know, learning how to get it out there. So I'm very pleased with how it's turning out, and I think people are enjoying it, which is the best part.
Well, that's wonderful. Yay.
Thank you so much for asking about it, and especially for having me here. I've loved talking with you. This has been a really interesting conversation. Thank you.
It has been. Lots of good reminders. And I think this work can definitely benefit anyone who's a musician, but they don't even have to be a musician, just everyone, right?
Yes. Yeah. I've had a lot of people tell me that the book isn't just for musicians. It's really for anybody.
And so how can people best connect with you and find out more about what you're doing just in general?
So my website is the best place, as well as Facebook. I'm there all the time. For better or for worse, I'm there a lot. My website is www.artoffreedom.me. So that's .me. And on Facebook, my profile page is public, and I also have a free Facebook group. It's called Make Great Music with Ease by Jennifer Roy Frankley. And so I'm very, very accessible, and I would love to hear from anybody who is curious or has any questions about anything we've talked about. I'm happy to personally respond to anything coming my way.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Laurel. I really appreciate your having me today. Absolutely. And having this talk with you. It's been great.
Yeah. Thanks again to Jennifer for sharing her work and her story with us. If you're intrigued, I encourage you to head over to her website, artoffreedom.me. That's artoffreedom.me, artoffreedom.me. And I will have all the links that we talked about in the show notes, including her website. On her website, you'll be able to learn more about working with Jennifer, both her self-study course and working with her one-on-one. You'll also be able to check out this CD that we've been hearing little clips of, and of course, her book, which is now available on Amazon. And at the very least, I encourage you to head to her Facebook group and to sign up. You'll be able to stay in touch with her and keep up with everything that she's doing. As always, I have a few reflections and takeaways I'd like to share about our conversation. But first, again, I'm Laurel Thompson, and my website is laurelthompson.com. That's LAURELTHOMSEN. You can head there to learn more about me, as well as the performance, teaching, and recording sides of my career. And especially if you're new to the podcast, I'd like to introduce you to its companion, the Violin Geek blog. If you head to my website and click the Violin Geek tab, the drop-down menu will show both the podcast and the blog. And the blog has tips, insights, and inspiration going back to 2007. So if you're new, you might have some catching up to do. Since the last podcast episode, I answered the question, when is it okay to hit pause in fixing issues in lessons? That was a teacher question, as well as the difference between a music teacher and a music coach, and a spiccato tutorial about how to create a more consistent bounce from string to string. So if any of that sounds interesting, then head over to laurelthompson.com and check out the Violin Geek blog. Also, if you've been enjoying the podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen and consider rating and reviewing the podcast so others can find it more readily. I really appreciate your time and your help in spreading the word. In thinking back over my conversation with Jennifer, there were so many great insights and reminders, but what really stuck with me was this idea of ourselves being the primary instrument and how important that is in order to come to our instrument, our musical instrument, in a way that's going to be successful, enjoyable, and a healthy relationship, so to speak. But first and foremost, we really have to have that healthy relationship with ourselves, again, our primary instrument. I really appreciate that she's talking about this. It's just something that I've always felt as a teacher. But in my case, where our primary goal is to create better playing and music, sometimes it feels a little bit strange to then go and talk about someone's mental state, someone's emotional state. And we mentioned how I do that sometimes, but then to really say that that's where we need to back up to sometimes feels a little bit like I'm crossing a boundary. And maybe I'm entering territory that would be better for a counselor or a therapist to intervene on and to chat with my student about. So I have to tread lightly. And it's just very nice to hear Jennifer describe it in a way that is just so simple and natural, yet profound. And it's not really about helping them. It's about showing them, kind of leading them to the door so that they can help themselves, perhaps, and for all of us to have that awareness where we can help ourselves, How am I approaching my violin today? How am I feeling? How do I feel in my body? And that lovely exercise she took us through where we're looking for a place that maybe just feels a little bit more easy, and we're creating a little bit of space away from maybe what's been filling our mindset so that we can be more aware of everything that's going on and to approach our playing with a little bit more neutrality, perhaps. Can kind of clear the decks and then see what is created in that space. So in this new year, I hope you will make wonderful improvements on your instrument, but I also hope that you will take this idea of a primary instrument being ourselves and to really cultivate this sort of atmosphere that will be conducive to learning an instrument and feeling curious about who you are and what you have to express through your instrument, because that's what we're all trying to do. So until next time, I hope you have a great month and happy practicing.